This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. The mercury is in the high 90s, the heat index has broken triple digits, and the news itself this week has felt a lot like a fever dream. But it's all too real, beginning with the Rolling Stone cover shot of alleged marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev.
We thought it was the apt image because we were trying to sort of draw this contrast between the person everyone thought they knew and the person he became.
Many Bostonians did not agree.
It just looked like they were making him look like a rock star, and it's not what he is.
In the trial of James Whitey Bulger, alleged victim Stephen Stippo Rakes had waited decades to take the stand against Bulger.
He's got his day up on the stand, and I'll have my day. Then we'll see what the difference is.
Rakes, however, never got that chance. He was found dead on Wednesday. Also in politics this week, Ed Markey is sworn in as the junior senator from Massachusetts.
We will be the hardest working delegation in the United States Senate.
Plus, the state Democratic Party chairman steps down in order to work for Deval Patrick's Political Action Committee. And today, the governor himself vetoes the transportation finance bill. We'll dig into these stories with our Week in Review panelists. But let's begin with the latest in testimony in the Bulger trial. Convicted murderer Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy returned to the witness stand for the prosecution today. WBUR's Asma Khalid is at the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston. Hello, Asma.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So this was the second day of testimony from Stephen Flemmy. His first few minutes yesterday were quite fiery. What was the mood like in the courtroom today?
Stephen Flemmy seemed a little bit more tired than he was yesterday. We didn't hear as many of these sort of big blows to the defense's arguments, but he provided a lot of details, particularly on two key issues. He implicated Bulger in the murder of six people. He also says that Bulger told him about murdering another two victims. And then what else I thought was kind of interesting is that we've consistently heard that Bulger was the ringleader of this group. Yesterday, Flemmy described Whitey Bulger as overbearing and forceful. But today, Flemmy, when he was asked, you know, well, how did you decide to kill so-and-so? He repeatedly insisted that they all decided as a group, that it was a consensus amongst the leaders of the Winter Hill Gang.
Huh, interesting. So a different sort of insight into allegedly how the Winter Hill Gang operated. Now, Flemmy was under questioning from prosecution today, and though in those murders that he detailed, there was one in particular that was especially gruesome, and that's the death of Deborah Davis.
Deborah Davis was Stephen Flemmy's old girlfriend. And he says that at some point he accidentally slipped and had told Deborah Davis about his and Whitey Bulger's relationship with former FBI agent John Connolly. Bulger, when he found that out, allegedly was very unhappy. He felt that now Deborah Davis could possibly jeopardize them, that she apparently knew too much about their relationship with John Connolly. And Stephen Flemmy says that thereafter, Bulger repeatedly insisted that he wanted to kill Deborah Davis. Flemmy says he initially did not agree, but he eventually acquiesced because he saw Bulger's point in the sense that possibly she could jeopardize them. According to Flemmy's testimony today, Bulger grabbed Davis by the neck and strangled her. The other Winter Hill Gang members took care of the cleanup and the burial of the body, but he insists that it was Whitey Bulger who actually strangled Deborah Davis to death.
Huh. So some emotional and gruesome testimony there from Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy. Asma, I'm wondering, throughout this entire trial, the one thing that Whitey Bulger, through his attorneys, has insisted was that under no circumstances was he an FBI informant. Did Stephen Flemmy speak to that at all today?
He did, but what was interesting is he seemed to point and reinforce and reiterate the fact that this relationship between the FBI was a quid pro quo relationship, one in which they provided a bit of information and the FBI offered tips back to them. He testified that every year they offered former FBI agent John Connolly $5,000 as a Christmas gift. They also paid him $5,000 for vacation at times. He testified that in total, he believes they paid John Connolly over $230,000. So I think the picture we got of this relationship between the Winter Hill Gang and the FBI was a bit more complicated. He also mentioned that not only was John Connolly on the Winter Hill Gang payroll, there were also four other FBI agents on that payroll. And in exchange, they were protected from being indicted in a race-fixing scheme. They were told when the FBI was on the heels of two Winter Hill fugitives. So they were consistently provided with information. And that's the picture he painted, that they got the benefit of this deal, not the other way around.
Huh. So Stephen Fleming is not done with his testimony. What do we have to look forward to next week?
Stephen Fleming will be back on the witness stand on Monday, and he'll be back to answer more questions from the prosecution. There are four other murders that Fleming has previously pled guilty to that Whitey Bulger is also accused of committing or accused of being involved in. So you can expect more details on those specific murders. Overall, the prosecution's case is moving very quickly, and actually at the end of today, they said that they hope to rest their entire case by the end of next week.
WBUR's Asma Khalid reporting to us from the Mokley Federal Courthouse in South Boston. Asma, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to our Week in Review panel. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Peter.
Thanks, Meghna.
Are you keeping cool over there at the Globe?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good. Stay hydrated. John Carroll also joins us. He's a communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. John, good to see you again.
Good to be here.
And you look like you're staying cool with me here in the studio.
Doing my best.
Okay, good. We've all got our water bottles in hand, so let's talk about the news. Peter, first, let's start with the Bulger trial. What do you make of sort of the day and some of Stephen the Rifleman Fleming's testimony so far?
Riveting and, you know, dramatic. And, you know, it certainly fills in some of the holes that the Bulger junkies want to know, that takes you inside the Winter Hill gang. But it also continues, I think, a pattern of very strong, persuasive testimony by the prosecution that suggests that this trial may not be the you know, the circus that some people had feared. And it, in fact, will be a fairly tight, successful prosecution.
John, your take so far?
First of all, we need nicknames. We absolutely have to adopt some
John,
nicknames.
John, the blogger, Carol.
I want to be actually boyfriend Johnny Carroll. anyway, you know, I think that there's this big debate over cameras in the courtroom. I think this thing should be on pay-per-view. It's got so many priceless moments. And Fleming and Bulger provided another one when they started cursing at each other yesterday. So I think that part is pretty vivid for the jury. I think that the prosecution has done a pretty good job, pretty tight job. It's going to be interesting to see what the cross-examination of Fleming is like. I think that that's going to be a sort of a tactical challenge for Jay Carney, Whitey Bulger's lawyer. I think it's going to be difficult for him to sort of spread the responsibility around. I don't think that part of it is going to really resonate with the jury very much, that, well, you know, all the kids were doing it, so why hold Whitey responsible?
Right. Spreading responsibility doesn't necessarily equate to absolution of responsibility.
I might add one thing. Let me add that one of the fascinating things around here is that there are two prosecutions going on. You know, there's the prosecution based on the law, and then there's the prosecution based on this kind of mob code. And so that's why you see Whitey snarling at Weeks and snarling at Fleming and, you know, who's snitching on whom. And the Deborah Davis, your reporter was talking about the Deborah Davis murder. I mean, that's one that Whitey desperately wants to avoid any responsibility for, to show that he would never touch a woman, he would never harm a woman. And so you're starting to see, as the case has gone forward, that there are two standards. There's the, you know, are you guilty of these murders? And the other standard is, in what ways did Whitey maintain, you know, some sort of a gangster code, and did people like Fleming and Weeks violate it? Mm-hmm. It's an interesting.
And it'll be interesting to see if the jury makes that distinction, the whole you can't rat on a rat distinction that John Martorano was trying to make, that Kevin Weeks was trying to make. I mean, I'm not sure the jury would see it that way necessarily, but I don't see how Whitey Bulger passes off the murder of Deborah Davis to anybody else. I mean, who's the other suspect here?
Right. Well, we can't leave our discussion about the Bulger trial without talking about the shocking twist that happened today regarding Stephen Rakes, who at one time was supposed to be a witness against Bulger. He claims that he is one of Bulger's victims. He was taken off the witness list and then on Wednesday found dead near a wooded trail in Lincoln, Mass. Peter, first of all, what do you think the impact of Stephen Rake's sudden death may have on the case, if any at all?
I don't think it'll have a big impact on the case, but I do think that it's a shocking thing for those who've been watching the trial as a kind of, you know, colorful blast from the past, watching these guys, now old men, snarling at each other. If Raikes is indeed murdered, or was indeed murdered, and the murder has something to do with what's going on in the courtroom there, you know, it's a reminder that there are still dangers out there. There are still people out there, that this is a serious business, and witnesses are risking their lives to testify. It brings this sort of colorful story from the past into the dangerous present.
Right into the present. In fact, we still don't have any official word about cause of death, but there is, I have seen officials saying that it may be suspicious. John, what's your quick take on this?
I think that it puts a chill into a lot of the families of the victims, the people who've been speaking out, and Stephen Raikes was very outspoken to the media. And the people who have been speaking out have to start to think twice at this point. And I'm not sure why it happened, but I have a feeling that it's going to sort of hang over the courtroom for the rest of the trial.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the other major news event this week, and that is Rolling Stone, on its August issue, putting that photograph, that selfie of Jahar Tsarnaev, and the controversy which ensued thereafter. Some people said that Rolling Stone was equating Tsarnaev to a rock star. Other people disagreed. Here's Will Dana. He's managing editor of Rolling Stone, and his reaction to people's reaction to their cover.
This is a person who is the same age as many of our readers, who to his peer group seemed like one of them. And that's what we thought made this story so powerful and disturbing. And, you know, it's in no way to endorse or glorify what he did. I think the opposite is, we're trying to understand it and to explain it.
Well, we spoke to some Bostonians this week in Copley Square about how they felt, and here is one reaction which was not unusual at all.
I mean, we're reminded of it every day, but to be able to go into a store and pick up a periodical that's in your face, I was not too happy with that at all. Them trying to feed me any information about this kid and what his story is, personally, I don't care what went wrong. I care that he took the time to injure unsuspecting Americans.
So, Peter, let's go to you first. You're an editorial page editor. You have to make decisions, I don't necessarily know photographically, but you know, journalistically, about editorial direction all the time. What do you make of Rolling Stone's decision first?
Well, we do make those decisions all the time, and I would defend Rolling Stone's decision on strictly journalistic grounds. I think it's a totally legitimate inquiry, as the editor was saying, for them to try to say, you know, answer the question that a lot of us in Boston have, which is, how can somebody who was allegedly well-adjusted at Cambridge Rich and Latin and at UMass Dartmouth and well-liked with a peer group of friends and teachers who really vouched for him at Cambridge, gave him a scholarship, and yet he became a jihadist? That's a big question. And the cover image, you know, would I have chosen it myself? Maybe not, but I think it's within the bounds of illustrating that question. You know, how did somebody who looks like this turn into somebody who was a monster? And that's what they said in the text. So, you know, it isn't like Rolling Stone was trying to in any way forgive, forget, glamorize what Tsarnaev did. They said he was a monster.
Right. And John, I mean, this same image appeared on the cover of the New York Times magazine, mm-hmm. I believe, not that long ago. But people seem to have an especially strong reaction to the fact that it was on Rolling Stone.
I think it's the publication itself. I mean, the Rolling Stone has a different position in the culture than the New York Times does. And so when it appears on the front page of the New York Times, it's sort of a documentary photo. It's in many ways just a news photo. Rolling Stone is largely an entertainment magazine, and there he is on the cover alongside Jay-Z and Willie Nelson. I mean, there are stories about them. One of the things that I thought was a tactical error on Rolling Stone's part is everybody keeps comparing this to the Charles Manson cover back in 1970. There was no other story on the cover except Charles Manson when his image appeared there. So I think that the fact that Jahar Tsarnaev was just one of a number of cultural figures, most of them in the entertainment business, I think that stung a little bit too. But this is an absolute Rorschach test. And I think that it's also revealing the gap between the general public and the media. The media have a completely different sensibility about this, and I think they have trouble understanding, you know, exactly how offensive this is. Mm. Intellectually is one thing, but emotionally, that's the real substance of this.
So then what do you make of the tit for tat, essentially, we saw today with the release, the unauthorized release from a state police officer of those photographs from the scene of when they captured Tsarnaev?
Well, I think that's a predictable reaction. I think a lot of people would have done exactly the same thing if they had access to those photographs. You want to balance out the picture. The problem is that not that many people are going to read the Rolling Stone story. All they're going to see is the cover. And by the way, if I could just add really quickly, that story, which everybody says is totally responsible, it's not like the cover, that story is Jahar Tsarnaev's defense strategy. It is all about how it's everybody's fault but his. And I think that the story actually doesn't help when you look at it in a particular light.
But you know, Jahar Tsarnaev was featured in another online publication, that being, you know, the Al-Qaeda newsletters. I mean, Al-Qaeda is out there calling on other Tsarnaev-type kids to do the same thing. And this is a huge threat to the United States, is the radicalization of seemingly normal, seemingly well-adjusted kids. So we can't stop asking those questions out of fear of somehow glamorizing these kids. This is the question of Homeland Security going forward. So having a journalistic inquiry into that question is entirely appropriate. The cover and the venue and the fact that it was Rolling Stone obviously triggered a kind of reaction, but we shouldn't also, you know, throw out the whole idea of a journalistic inquiry into these questions, that anything that that probes Jahar Tsarnaev's humanity is somehow giving him too much credit or glamorizing him or humanizing him. That's the real question here.
Yeah.
How did somebody become a jihadist?
Well, I haven't heard that much or any at all criticism of the actual article itself. It just seems it's the imagery of the cover that really provoked most of the reaction. But on that point, before we run out of time, I just want to be sure that we cover quickly politics as well, because to a certain degree, everything is political. And we must note that Ed Markey became the junior senator from Massachusetts this week. And the fact that he's a brand new senator and Elizabeth Warren has only been in for a short period of time makes Massachusetts the most junior delegation in the Senate since the Senate first convened in 1789. And here's how Senator Markey reacted to that.
Elizabeth Warren and I are replacing John Kerry and Ted Kennedy and their seniority, which was 75 years. So we're going to partner now to ensure that Massachusetts has the highest quality representation, which is humanly possible. We will be the hardest working delegation in the United States Senate.
So, John Carroll, what do you make of Markey's swearing in, if anything at all, and what do you have to look forward to?
Well, I think the Globe kind of stepped on his swearing in ceremony when they ran right alongside the picture of him being sworn in, a story that about Ed Markey making a phone call to the president of UMass, essentially vouching for a friend of his who was fighting for a lobbying contract. And it looked like influence peddling. Maybe technically it wasn't, but it certainly made Ed Markey look like the inside player that he's been accused of being. Whether that's going to work to his benefit in the Senate is hard to know, but I think it was a little bit of a rocky start from the standpoint of, you know, this is something where this guy is playing a game that's a very inside game, and you wonder, is it his friends that are getting his attention first, or is it the people's business in Massachusetts?
Peter, your take?
Well, I certainly agree with John that the phone call was inappropriate on Markey's part, and it was not a great, you know, thing for Markey to have out there on the day that he was being sworn in. I do think that, you know, Markey's seniority and understanding of Washington and all that was part of his appeal. It's part of why he was elected. He may not be a very senior senator. In fact, only one day of seniority as a senator, but he has, you know, four decades practically in the U.S. House, and that counts for something, too. Half the people, I think, in the Senate are former House members who served with Markey. So, you know, he's going to have to be that sort of senior inside guy, and we'll see how it works out.
Yeah. Well, we've got just enough time now to talk about our hubbubs, because there has been so much like heavy news this week. I'm hoping that our hubbubs lighten the load a little bit. So, John, let's start with you.
Well, mine comes from BuzzFeed, a website that's normally known for features like the 25 most epic cat beards of all time. But actually, they had a terrific article about Manny Ramirez playing baseball in Taiwan, in the Chinese Professional Baseball League, and essentially turning around the financial fortunes of that league, trying to get a little redemption himself. He's been signed by the Texas Rangers to a minor league contract. He's playing in AAA, and he even cut his hair to join the Texas Rangers organization. So I recommend it. It's a really terrific article.
A BuzzFeed giving you something to talk about on Hubbub. That's terrific. Peter Kanellis, your Hubbub.
This is a story about human nature, but with a sad ending, in the sense that an art thief in Europe was hiding major masterpieces in his mother's house, and she, thinking that she could prevent him from going to prison and spare him the evidence against him, destroyed the paintings, which is a sad story. But it made me think, obviously, of our own missing artwork from the Gardner Museum and the many calls that have been made to people who might have knowledge of that case, and the importance with which people have to preserve these masterpieces wherever they are and do everything they can to get them back to where they belong.
Oh, wow. Well, my hubbub is in honor of the heat wave we've been having, and a place that I would have usually run to help curb the heat, and that is a Brigham ice cream parlor, except pretty soon we won't be able to do that because H.P. Hood of Linfield, which owns the Brigham's brand, says it's not making enough money on the 3-gallon tubs of ice cream it sells to franchise parlors, and so they're going to discontinue that line this summer, meaning that the parlors are going to close. And I used to go to a Brigham's parlor on the Belmont-Cambridge line all the time, and it was just one of those sort of, you step back in time, the idea that there's just an ice cream parlor from a company that's been in Massachusetts for, 100 years or thereabouts. You can still buy them in supermarkets, but no Brigham's parlors pretty soon. The line will be discontinued this summer. So get
end of an era.
Exactly. Not to say we don't have a lot of ice cream in Massachusetts as it is, but Brigham's ice cream parlors, rest in peace. I think of you fondly. Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, always great to have you. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
And John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog, thank you as well.
Thanks, Magna.
I hope both of you stay cool and stay out of the heat.
You too.
Stick with us, because coming up, we will talk about a battle raging in the field of psychology over emotion science. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.